You're listening to a podcast of a program produced in 2013 as part of Aloud, a series of dynamic conversations, readings, and performances that take place in the Mark Taper Auditorium at the historic Downtown Central Library in the heart of Los Angeles. These programs are presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles, which supports the Los Angeles Public Library. To support Aloud or learn about the entire podcast collection, please visit www.lfla.org/aloud. Good evening and welcome to Aloud at Central Library. We're very excited about our Graphic Canon panel tonight, and I want to welcome you all here to the Central Library. I'm Louise Steinman, the Program Director for the Library Foundation of Los Angeles and the curator of the Aloud series. In her review of the Graphic Canon in the New York Times last fall, the reviewer wrote, "There is a synergistic relationship between language and art that is rooted deep within our nature. Great literature leaves us not just with extraordinary stories. The language also leaves an image, a rich and expansive painting of the world written on the page. In the Graphic Canon, the world's literature is reimagined as comics and visual art, and with it, the editor, Russ Kick, has struck a chord. Has he ever? Editor Russ Kick has assembled an amazingly impressive group of more than 100 artists. We have like five tonight, so there's 95 more in the wings ready to come out, to illustrate, adapt, and visually interpret this three-volume epic, which ranges from, literally, the Epic of Gilgamesh in Volume 1 to Gravity's Rainbow and David Foster Wallace's Infinite Jest in Volume 3. Russ, plus four of the artists chosen for the series, are with us tonight, and actually we have the editor of the Graphics Canon. Where are you, Veronica? Right there. So this is very unusual. She's worked on this all this time and gets to meet some of these authors in person tonight. And I also want to thank Ruth Weisberg, also at Seven Stories Press, for working with us on this program. So tonight's panelists, in no apparent order, so you'll indicate who you are as I read your name. Tonight's panelists are Frank M. Hansen, a cartoonist, artist, and writer who creates humorous cartoons for various print and digital publications around the globe. Frank is currently working on a new strip based on a washed-up Hollywood mogul. I wonder who that would be. His work has been shown at Gallery Nucleus, WWA Gallery, and the Redgate Gallery in London. Milton Knight, I think, who anchors the far corner over there, his work has appeared in Graphic Classics, Heavy Metal, High Times, Nickelodeon Magazine, and his comic titles include Hugo, Midnight, The Rebel Skunk, and Slug and Ginger. He's currently exhibiting and teaching at the Colonnade Art Gallery and Studio in Pasadena, California. And Sharon Rudall, right here, began drawing comics for underground newspapers and the first women's comics. Her work has been exhibited in museums in San Francisco, New York, and Europe. And recent projects include Dangerous Woman, the graphic biography of Emma Goldman, and major contributions to Harvey Pekar's Yiddishkeit, Stud Terkel's Working, and the upcoming Bohemians. And Zach Smith, down there. His paintings and drawings are held in major private and public collections worldwide, including the Museum of Modern Art and the Whitney. Other than pictures showing what happens on each page of Thomas Pynchon's novel Gravity's Rainbow, his books include the monographs Pictures of Girls and We Did Porn, a book including drawings and stories about his experiences working in the adult film industry. And our editor right here, Russ Kick, the editor of the three-volume, 1,600-page set, Graphic Canon, the world's great literature as comic and visuals, which NPR called easily the most ambitious and successfully realized literary project in recent memory. Russ's earlier books for the disinformation company include You Are Being Lied To, Everything You Know Is Wrong, The Disinformation Guide to Secrets and Lies, and 50 Things You're Not Supposed to Know. The Etney Reader named him one of 50 visionaries who are changing your world. So we hope this changes your world. I'll turn it over to you, Russ, and please enjoy the Graphic Canon.
Thank you, Louise, and thank you all for coming out to hear about this merging of high culture and low culture. And, of course, by high culture, I'm talking about the visual arts, the sequential comics, illustration, and low culture is the pulp fiction that Dickens and Shakespeare and Keats wrote because they needed a paycheck. We'll kind of get to that in a little while, actually. But the idea with the graphic canon was simply to continue this tradition of visual artists and performing artists through the centuries who have used classic literature as the basis for their art. This is really nothing new that's going on. It's just we happen to be, I think, in a golden age of comic art, sequential art, illustration in general. It's impossible to keep up with the amazing work that's coming out, the innovations, the talent out there. And it just seemed like now was the time. And this is obviously not a new idea. There is the famous Classics Illustrated line of comics that ran from 1941 to 1971. If you look back on those, a lot of baby boomers have fond memories of them, but they were kind of by the numbers. You know, the artists were not encouraged to take chances. But with this, I asked the artists to just have at it. I wanted them to stay true to the literature, to not make up new adventures for the characters, not set Huck Finn in the future or anything like that. But visually, they could do whatever they wanted, any approach. And we ended up with this amazing kaleidoscope of visual approaches and narrative styles. And when I approached Seven Stories about doing this, Dan Simon, the head of Seven Stories, he immediately got it. By our second email, he was talking like he was publishing this. That's it. And I pitched one volume, oversized soft cover of 400 pages. But when I started getting in touch with the artists, there was so much interest, and I started finding things to reprint from some obscure sources. And it ended up being 3/4 new material across all 3 volumes and 1/4 reprinting the best of what had been done. And I told Dan, can we make this 500 pages? I've got so much material here, I could go to a second volume already. So he said, let's make it 2 volumes. And then 2 weeks later, he said, let's make it 3 volumes. And we were actually going to release them simultaneously as a set, but the distributor talked us out of that, just put a little bit of rain on the Dan's visions. So we're now up to volume 3. They go in chronological order. Volume 1 covers from the ancient times to the end of the 1700s. Volume 2 is all about the 1800s. And then volume 3 is the 20th century, from the turn of the century until 1996. Yeah, I guess the first question I'd like to ask is, it's something I get asked all the time, which is, why are we doing this in the first place? Why graphically adapt classic literature? What are we bringing to this? And I think we already got a very interesting personal answer from Zach, which was to basically exorcise the images from a very complex, demanding novel. Anything else? Why are we doing this? What does it bring to the table?
It's like an opportunity to jam with these guys that you really love, to participate in what they did and bring something to the party. So I guess that's why I like to do it.
I guess it is a nice opportunity to take something that you appreciated or for whatever reason, and now by putting your own sort of spin or art on it, you sort of feel like you're sort of participating with that particular author, and that's a nice feeling.
Especially with the ancient stuff. I mean, it's like you're reaching across space and time, having mm-hmm. this contact with another mind. Even if you think you experience something deeply, when you spend like weeks drawing it, it's a different experience.
Yeah. I'll say that doing it, and probably it happened to all of us, but going through it, you sort of realize that you have to break down the story and you have to get into the story, and yet by creating your art for it, it sort of makes the process in itself makes you get into it, and it's rewarding because you get to know the work much better than you would have as just a regular reader.
Mm-hmm. So. Yeah, and both of your answers make me think of like one big reason that I was not, I gave you just like, there was free rein. There was no checking in. I didn't even see, most cases I didn't see roughs or pencils or anything. I just got the final art. And it was like Christmas every day. And, but yeah, I wanted that sense of, yeah, you were really finding your own meaning in it, and it was a collaboration with the writer and you. Yeah, and something, you know, I do get asked, you know, some people think that there should not be graphic, these comic adaptations of literature, that somehow it's doing a disservice to the original. If you run into that.
I mean, I was terrified of that. I feel like I'm, if you've ever seen a really terrible movie made of a book that you like.
All the time, yeah.
Well, there you go. I mean, so I didn't want to be the guy who did that to my favorite author, you know? And so I felt like I was in a weird competition. I might not have felt that way if it had been Mark Twain or something, or it's like every other person, you know what I mean? Like that's, you know, but it was like the, that was going to be that guy's press that year, you know? And it was like, I have read Nabokov's writing about Kubrick's movie, you know, and you're just like, you know, if Kubrick had read that first, he probably would have been like, fuck, I'm not going to make Lolita. You know what I mean? Like, it's like, you don't want to do them a disservice. Like, and so I felt like if you're going to, it's like you're stepping into the ring with them almost. I mean, I feel not competitive, like I want to be better, but competitive in like, you have to prove that you're doing something that brings to the table. You're bringing a bunch of stuff to the table, and they brought a bunch of stuff to the table, and then people are going to look at them right next to each other, mm-hmm. you know? And so you don't want to be a supplement. I have a copy of Faust that Harry Clark did. Harry Clark is this great kind of after Aubrey Beardsley illustrator, and it's great. It's like you don't know whether you want to read Faust or you want to read look at the pictures, and that's like – or the best one in the world is Alice in Wonderland. Like most, when we see an Alice in Wonderland movie, most of what we actually see was not invented by Lewis Carroll. It was invented by John Tenniel, and the striped socks. You know, like people are still wearing his socks that he invented. You know what I mean? Like,
right.
You could go buy those red and white striped socks because it's such a powerful image.
There is actually no physical description of Alice in those books.
Yeah. She's not even blonde. The text. You know, yeah. And so if Alice is blonde or has stripy socks or the caterpillars, you know, like all those things are his. And he competed so totally with the prose that I felt like, you know, that's who I wanted to be. You know, like I wanted to be somebody who is like, bringing the same amount, you know, and it was scary to do less, you know.
Mm-hmm. And have you heard back anything from Thomas Pynchon or his
I mean, people? He's famously reclusive. But I didn't want to fuck it up, right? And I knew about 5 months in, a museum contacted me, and they're like, when you're done, we'll put it in the show. And so I was like, shit. So I wrote to him, and I was like, if someone was making a movie of a book, they'd have to get permission. I don't have to get permission, but I don't want to – you're alive. I don't want to be a jerk. So I wrote – his manager is his wife, or his agent is his wife. She's a big literary agent. So I wrote a letter to them, and the answer I got back was like, well, maybe don't say it's illustrations for every page of Gravity's Rainbow. And I'm like, but that's the point. Like, no one is – like – no one's ever done that before. Like, I was the first person to do that, and then a wonderful guy, Matt Kish, is now doing it with Moby Dick. But it was in, like, you know, I got a job too. I wanted to be like, this is what I did. It's crazy. People need to know. So we went back and forth, and then eventually I wrote an email saying, look, the impression I get is that you wish I had never asked you and that I had just gone ahead and done it. And that you kind of don't want to get away of an artist making their art, but you also don't want to be like, this is the official thing in case it sucks. Mm-hmm. And if this is true, give me no response. I will call the office, ask your secretary if you got this email, and if she says yes, then we're done.
Right.
And so I did that, and I called, and I was like, "Did you get it?" And she's like, "Yeah." And then that was it. So it was like my official Thomas Pynchon response is no response. And like once in a while, once in a while in New York, someone will be like, "Oh, I live in his building or something," and I want me to ask him, and I'm like, "Yeah." But then they had a thing where they had modern classic authors pick people to do their covers, and he picked Frank Miller. So I feel like that was kind of what. That was his way of. I always feel like, oh, okay.
Okay.
But then, you know, who wouldn't? It's Frank Miller, right?
Yeah. So, it's easier to beg for forgiveness than ask for permission. Is the theme there? Yeah.
All of the stuff that I've adopted has been public domain by necessity. Even the Zora Neale Hurston stories were picked from a period that were not copyrighted because her family is very protective of that, of her work. So in a way, there was a distancing with all this stuff, and it was basically, It's difficult with these old stories. A lot of times you look at graphic adaptations of classic stories, and they look like school pageants. Like I said, up on the podium, their characters are doing things because the text tells them to. And it looks like a lot of times the artist is doing them because they're necessary. There is no joy taken. There is no attempt to say, well, how can I relate to this? And how can I best use the story? A lot of times it just feels like, okay, I'll get it done. And I've tried to combat against this by making the stories more cinematic, not relying on the dialogue to, tell the story all the time. I mean, comics are a blend. And if you can use words without pictures, I believe in doing that. And so I'm hoping for a fresh approach with these stories, no matter how arcane the authors are.
Yeah, and one point I always try to make is that the original text is always there for anyone who wants to go back to it. You know, you haven't taken that away, but yeah, hopefully you've added to it. One metaphor I like that isn't exact, but it kind of gets the point across, is like musicians doing cover versions of songs from other bands. I mean, you're in some sense, you're doing your own cover version of this work. And, there's just a million ways to do that. One thing I'd like to do is actually like pick just one short story or one short poem.
And let different artists do it.
And have at least a dozen artists do that one thing without communicating with each other, and just see, how many different, wildly different interpretations we'd get. Now, another thing I wanted to ask, this comes up in interviews and reviews a lot, is that there's this idea that maybe adapting classic literature in general, and the graphic canon specifically, will add respectability to comics, sequential arts, illustration in general. And I'm wondering, any reactions to that?
They've been adding or working on adding dignity and what was the word you used?
Respectability
to comics for the last 30 years, almost 40. And I think it's very self-conscious. I think that it was started by people who couldn't come up with funny stories in the first place, and that it's it can be a substitute for coming up with ideas yourself, and that's what I see a lot, and I think it's weighed comics down considerably. And adopting stories was something I adopted myself too. Frankly, I do prefer to tell original stories, but that's simply not where the market is right now. It's kind of an academic thing that's going on, and I miss fantasy comics. I don't mean sword and sorcery. I just mean where a character can step from one star to another, and you know, maybe that'll come back, maybe it won't. But right now it seems to be all be about either it's education or it's total degeneracy and angry superheroes killing each other for basically no reason. And not a lot in between. I instead of bringing respectability to comics, I wish they would just start talking to normal people again.
Yeah, I was going to say, I've had a pet theory for many years that becoming respectable is the death knell of any art. It's when it's not respectable that it's really any good. That's a lot. For a while, the New York Times was actually printing comics, and they were very carefully vetted not to have any feelings or any ideas or, God forbid, any politics, to still have that sort of distanced New York art scene. You know, the whole reason that I do comics is because it's not any of those things, because it is a street medium and a crude medium, and it still has heart to it. Respectable things are the things that return people, you know, buy and sell, or that people go buy $300 tickets to listen to and don't really listen to. They just text while they're there. It's the unrespectable things that really count. Not to mention, I mean, the rock and roll of my heyday compared to when it became respectable, or Philip K. Dick compared to real literature in his time, or Raymond Chandler compared to what people learned in college writing classes. You know, God forbid we should ever become respectable. That would be the end of it. I'll have to find something else to do.
Yeah, I mean, I think totally. Like, I feel like there's, like, Batman, right? And then there's, like, violin music that you only ever hear in colleges now, you know, like, so there's academic, and then in the middle there's this where the money is, which is like, it's not kids stuff, it's not academic, it's like this stuff that critics can write about and be like the Tarantino zone.
And they can give expensive college classes.
Right, and this is, you know, video games are going to get here because there's so much money in video games, but comics aren't. Comics are going to go right from here to here. It's going to be like Art Spiegelman, Jack Kirby. I think it's going to be like that forever because, I mean, in the fine art world, which is where, like, that's where my stuff is usually reviewed, it's like, they used to just be like, oh, comics is comics. And now they're like, well, comics is fucking complicated and it's for other people. You know what I mean? They've gone from like dismissing comics as being like, well, for kids stuff, to dismissing comics as being like, well, that's for those other nerds, you know, like different nerds than art nerds. So it's like, even if it's too involuted for the New York fine art world to even, like, it's, that shit is complicated, then I feel like, you know, Art Spiegelman's work is done. You know, it's, we're teaching it. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. So I don't actually see this zone as being, I don't think it'll happen because we've become at best an arm of the movie industry. Like, if you do a really good comic, they'll make a movie. And then you'll stop making comics because you just made movie money.
Well, they're actually farming out, getting people to make comics that are really just intended to be.
I know. I get things in my inbox like, you could draw comics, right? I have this idea about a high school, and in the high school, like, one of the kids is a werewolf and the other one is all radioactive in it. But I really just want a movie. And I'm like, well, don't talk to me. Like, I like the things I make. It's just a horrible place to be. But
movies are like the greatest example of what I'm talking about. I mean, when movies actually were art is when everybody thought they were trash. Yeah. And once people started taking them seriously, well, my point is made.
We're there now.
Yeah. Yeah.
You look like you're...
Pretty much, I mean, yeah, I agree with everything that they're saying. And it's really just a shame that it's sort of come to that. And within the movie industry, I mean, you really see that in sort of this sort of mashup now that you see at Comic-Con now with it's just movies and the comics.
It's what we used to call commodified back in my heyday.
Yeah, and
it's all just product.
Now it's just called Wednesday.
Yeah, and the comic book stores, I mean, for the most part, unless it's some sort of alternative store in the first place, they're not going to really carry any sort of other type of alternative comics in any way, shape, or form. It's mostly going to be the superhero stuff or something that's sort of popular and may not be superhero, and they'll carry that as well. And yeah, it's sort of a shame, but I don't see any end to it. I think Zach's exactly right. I think the way he put it, but I don't know.
But as long as people keep scrawling naughty pictures on walls and writing what they think, it's the medium will continue. It's safe.
Yeah. I mean, it's. Yeah.
But respectability, I know that would be the end.
Okay, well. Yeah, Milton used the word educational at one point, and that reminded me. Yeah, my mindset was, I realized that this could get used in some educational settings, although there is a lot of sex and nudity throughout the three volumes that has apparently shocked people who didn't realize that classic literature actually deals with that aspect of the human condition too. That apparently they don't know that. But so yeah, there's no way these are actually getting into schools, although I knew they could be used in universities, but that was never the point. This was always meant as an art project. And there was a little bit of disagreement between Dan Simon and myself about the further reading section in the back. I was not a big fan of it. I thought it made it a little too educational. But in the end, they ended up in the back of each volume, and actually that's okay. I mean, I'm fine with that. But this was meant as an art project, not as an educational project. That's the angle that it was coming from. But you know, in the end, if it does get more people interested in either aspect of it, interested in the artists or interested in the authors, then you know that's a great side effect of this. I wanted to ask you also: is there any literature that you feel should not be adapted, cannot be adapted, should be left alone? The one thing that I always think of is Finnegan's Wake. You know, I'm not sure. Okay.
I don't know if like anything shouldn't be done, but I think that probably everybody at this table has had this experience where you don't want to draw one more person talking because there's dialogue. Like after I did the Gravity's Rainbow piece, I was like, I'll do another book and I'll just pick my next favorite book. And then I was like, there's no way for me to draw this page without it being two people in a room talking, and then the next one, two people in a room talking. So, you know, it was like, there are people who can do that. Mm-hmm. It's just not me. So there are lots of books that I shouldn't be doing, right. And I think that goes for every artist. You know, right. Like, you would rely on your bag of tricks and your bag of easy-for-you-to-do stuff too much if you did it. And I think that whoever does it has to have some way to do it rather than it being assigned to them. I know that like Matt Weagle, who did a great piece in the first one, was working for a company that did Cliff's Notes in comics for a while, and he would get assigned. And it was like, and that was a whole, it was like, well, do I just draw Romeo talking to Juliet again? In other words, Shakespeare has given you a lot more in the next page, and I have given you the same thing I gave you on the last page. And so I hope that we never get to the point where we've just got that guy who goes, okay, Romeo looks like this, he looks like this again, he looks like this again. Like, you know, you don't want to do that thing. But
you want to keep pondering how you can use your skills, your bag of tricks, to convey something new and enlarge.
Right.
I mean, I think it's almost like taking a story and making choreography of it. It's not going to be the same as the written story. You're going to use the dancers' bodies and the music and the lighting and whatever. You have your own different bag of tricks that you can use to make something come alive.
Right, and if just because it's the bridge or something again, or it's the chorus again, you don't draw the same thing again.
Right. Maybe you draw the chorus's feet as they shuffle.
Right.
Maybe that's what's important. You know, or they're in silhouette in the background and you see the landscape around them. I mean, you have everything that a movie with a $1 billion production budget has, you know, if you're just willing to work your ass off for no money.
That's the comics mantra.
That's the problem.
You can do anything in the world as long as you're willing to work your ass off for no money.
Right. Mm-hmm. And now you guys know. Don't become cartoonists.
I miss page rates myself.
God, page rates.
Yeah. when comics were actually a career rather than this weird, it's like, oh, they're saying all the time, oh, there are more exciting things happening than ever before. And I admit, I see a lot of good stuff out there. But, I mean, exactly where does it go? It's just hard to judge. It's like people don't want to say it out loud, but this is no longer a business. And, I don't know. Being an art form is fine, but if only the big fish can make money out of it, then I see it as basically an amateur status thing. And, amateur status is, more free. I mean, you get to do basically your own thoughts and your own ideas rather than having them dictated. But I started doing this in the 80s, and at the time I chose it because it not only wasn't what I always wanted to do, but it was also a career. And frankly, I'm not happy with the way it's going. I wish it would focus itself rather than using all this free and easy joy where there's a big question going on here about its future.
Well, I think it's a problem of all, quote, content providers. You know, all the writers and artists and photographers and everybody now, the cartoonists are in the same boat with all of them. We're competing with all the amateurs all over the world. Yeah. And, you know, nobody wants to pay for what they're then going to distribute. So, I mean, I would suggest in union there is strength. If we could get everyone to agree to exist on certain basic standards would be
our
best.
Well, we managed to get 4 artists to agree on something at this table for the first time I've ever heard. So, but yeah, I mean, it is a career.
It's not easy.
People are in it for life, so let's unionize. That's a good idea.
So going back for a second to what Zach said about visual approaches, I did like the way that over the course of 1,600 pages and 181 different pieces, it became kind of an encyclopedia almost of how to approach visual storytelling. There's so many different ways, and I was constantly surprised when new things came in about the ways people had found to visually represent these works. Oh, and as far as Finnegan's Wake goes,
that... You could do it.
Yeah, and it's actually, it is in the public domain in the UK at this point. It's still copyrighted in the US, and James Joyce's estate is known as being
working on Blood Meridian
bad.
Right now. So.
Oh, excellent. That'll be nice to see. That's Dame Darcy did that in volume 3. There, she did 4 standalone illustrations.
4?
Mm-hmm. There's only so much room.
Well, like a few things happen in there. Someone gets shot, someone rides a horse. It's.
Well, there's the Indian attack where they're dressed in the clothes of the people that they've killed before, including the wedding veil and the corset, which is just kind of a legendary scene.
Yeah.
And the tree that's hung with dead babies.
And that Sean Chang drew the Indian attack. You look up Sean Chang if he's not in there.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, he's in there. Yeah, he did one of the Brother Grimm's fairy tales in Volume 2. So, okay. I think we're getting to the point of audience Q&A.
Is that okay? Do you want to? This looks like there's a young lady.
Mm-hmm. Hi, I just had a question about what it was like to edit this book, because I heard that on one level it was very personal, and you wanted to let the artists have their reader response and do what they do.
Mm-hmm.
But then I also heard Mr. Hansen talking about changing the end of what he was doing with Kipling, and I'm wondering, you also have pressure, like Zach was saying, you don't want to fuck it up when there's this pressure of historic literature, and you have an editor on your side telling you what needs to be there. So what is it like on the artist side to feel like you're being edited And what is it like for you as an editor to try to manage what people are expressing personally when they experience this literature?
Okay, yeah, I'll answer the editor part first, which is that I did keep a really light hand in this, I have to say. Frank is one of the very few exceptions across all three volumes, because he took, you know, If by Rudyard Kipling, I mean, that is a deadly serious poem. I mean, he's not kidding around. And Frank has a very whimsical style, and I liked the meeting of those two. It was just the very, very last line. I didn't think it was, it just got a little too whimsical, so you...
No, I agree, and that was a very minor thing, and it was just a suggestion. Russ never even asked to see anything. I offered to show it to him, and then he mentioned suggesting something else, but really he left it completely up to me, so that, just to clarify. And I think you're right. I think it was a little, you know, I think I'd gotten a little bit away from the poem. What I was trying to do, even the satirical take I was going on. And I think in some of the verses, I think I even do that. I think I somewhat stray, where, you know, I was trying to stay within the spirit of Rudyard Kipling's poem, but at the same time, do a satirical take. And at the end, I think I did just sort of go, sort of no holds barred, kind of a weird. It was a weird thing about commercialism and all this stuff at the end. It was kind of odd.
But I also think, like, when you first finish something, you don't know if it's good or not. Like, when you first finish it for, like, a week. So yeah. I think sometimes just you have, it's nice to have an editor just so you can just be like, I take no responsibility for this. For a second. It's you know, true, like, true. I think after a few months, you can kind of tell if you did a good job. But, like, I mean, I got lucky, and that's the thing that I was doing took so long that by the time I was done, I could look at the beginning and be like, oh,
right.
You know, and I replaced a lot, but you can see how if you're doing a thing.
No, absolutely, yeah. That's very true.
A good
true.
Editor can be a kind of collaboration where their ideas bounce off your ideas and actually might push you in directions you wouldn't think of otherwise. But I think it's a lot like any relationship. I mean, you have to have your own boundaries of where you say, no, that's I don't do things like that, or no, that's not a change I'm willing to make. Yeah, well, I'm a difficult person for editors and other things. So you have to be very firm. I mean, and that's the upside of working for no money, that it's actually very easy to walk away if they don't let you do what you want to do. What's in it for me, you know?
And then, yeah, actually, that was kind of an incentive, too.
I would never have worked for you otherwise.
Yeah, and no money is not theoretically correct.
But no, but I mean...
Low money, yeah, okay. Low money. But, yeah, one of the incentives was that...
Freedom.
Total artistic freedom. And, yeah, I think I asked for maybe changes to, like, 5 or 6 of the pieces, because I think otherwise everybody just... really hit it right on the head, and a lot of times it was, you know, it was their call, it's their interpretation, it's their cover of this song, and, you know, yeah, I didn't feel like stepping in very often.
A question about the word canon that is in the title here. I think we've talked a little bit about what literature is and it isn't, but when you say something's in the canon, you're actually saying there's stuff that's not good enough to be in this. And I was wondering if there was something that... Is there a process? Because it sounds like some of the people got to choose the stories that they made. And
right.
Is there a process? Were there things that were actively excluded from the graphic canon that might not be considered worthy? Or?
Oh, well... It wasn't really, yeah, it wasn't worthiness. I did choose the title canon to kind of get across the epicness of the project. I wanted that to be clear just from the title. And I knew it would raise some hackles, and it has. Because, well, it's such a complicated question. I mean, there's no official canon, obviously. There's no body setting what's in the canon. It's just kind of, there are certain works that are just more widely taught, more widely studied they stay in print constantly, they get translated constantly, they get made into movies and plays constantly. It's, you know, that all of that kind of argues for something being considered canonical. It's almost a self-selecting process and kind of cyclical. But that said, I did try to expand the bounds of what's considered canonical. Volume 2 has Venus in Furs, which is a famous work of erotica, masochistic erotica from the 1800s. And there's the hashish eater is in there. And in the 20th century, there's the Maltese Falcon, which, you know, a lot of academics will not allow any genre fiction into the canon, no matter how good it is. But I think some of the absolute best science fiction, best detective novels, erotica, these things actually should be considered, you know, more widely accepted in the canon. I don't know if anyone else has any feelings about that.
So you weren't staking your claim to this being a specific canon. It was just a nice word to use as part of the title, or?
That was part of it.
Oh.
That was just to get
now
the idea across
of
what's in there, yeah.
Essential selections and reading?
That could work. It doesn't have quite the same ring to it, but
oh no, I'm just
it's kind of a synonym there. Yeah,
okay.
I'd agree with that.
Zach, I'd like to know if after 750 works of art, you're through with Gravity's Rainbow.
That's a good question. Actually, I feel like I did that. Like I got it out of my head, which was the point. Like, I felt like it's a really complicated novel, and I did all those pictures, and then after a year of doing that and thinking about almost nothing else, I felt like I can read it again, but that certain way of like thinking about that people get about certain things, it's gone, it's out. So in that way, I think it was a useful exercise in order to get to some other creative projects I was working on and just other ideas and stuff. So, yeah.
In Finnegan's Wake. Putting a little.
I'd like to do War and Peace, actually.
You want to do War and Peace?
No, I'd like to do it, yeah.
Okay, well.
Race, yeah.
Right. It's on.
Frost, you mentioned thinking of doing a collaboration of artists on a particular short poem or story. Do you have any source material in mind?
Oh, for the idea where to have at least a dozen artists do the same one?
Yeah, that'd be cool.
No, actually, it hasn't gone past that germ of an idea. I don't know if you have a suggestion for a story or a poem that would lend itself to lots of different interpretations, yeah, let me know. But yeah, maybe a future volume of the graphic canon will have a section. I'm not sure if Seven Stories would risk doing an entire book of, say, 25 takes on the same short story. It may end up being a part of a future one. And I'll have to figure out what would fit that really well.
Rashomon. No-brainer, right? It's like a short story, right? Before it was a movie? I think it was. But anyway.
It was, yeah.
There you go. All right.
Yeah. Hi. I just had a follow-up question to what the gentleman over there asked. Did you choose all of the stories and then assign the artists, or did you just go and ask the artists what they wanted to do, or was it a combination of both things? I mean, it's this whole idea of like this canon business and everything like that. I mean, who really cares what the academics or want to teach or not? But the fact is that it depends on what department in the university you're in. You know, I mean, so it, you know, I mean, the Maltese Falcon is taught, you know, in one department and not in the other department, mm-hmm. and they argue with one another about why it should or shouldn't be taught, you know. But in terms of dealing with popular culture and you know, how one communicates to an audience, basically, and when the authors are writing the books, that's what they're doing, and when the artists are interpreting, or music is interpreting, or painters have done that forever as well. Mm-hmm. So how did you come about with picking which books and which pieces to use, and how did the artists come to meet up with those things?
You know, there's a combination of things going on. I had a wish list of works that I really wanted to see adapted, that I was hoping would be in there. Some of them I wanted adapted just because they would be really conspicuous if they weren't in there. I mean, there would be like huge gaps if Beowulf weren't in there, Shakespeare's major plays, Huckleberry Finn, some A-list works. And then other works that I felt had a lot of visual potential. So I would send that wish list, but I also said, if you have anything in mind that you want to do, just let me know. And that happened a lot. Happened with Sharon. And there were actually a bunch of artists who had wanted to adapt something for years, but had never had a reason to, never had an outlet for it. And that's how Rebecca Dart did Paradise Lost in Volume 1. She did 12 amazing full-page illustrations, beautifully hand-lettered, that essentially it is a sequential comic in a way, because it does tell the story all the way through. And when I contacted Dame Darcy, she had just done an interview a few weeks ago where they asked her, what's your dream project? And she said to adapt the Alice in Wonderland novels. So then a few weeks later, I came along, and she claimed those and turned in this really amazing black and white work, where she used a lot of white ink on black paper. So that happened a bunch of times.
Yeah, this was for a comment I think Zach made about describing the space of commercial comics as being very, very polar, like maybe Jack Kirby and Art Spiegelman, I think, was your example, like something purely escapist and something that's maybe self-consciously capital A art. And you also mentioned with nothing in between. And I was curious what you think about comic artists like Neil Gaiman or Alan Moore, like people who I feel like they do work that's a lot of fun, that really seems like it's comics to be comics, but is arguably interesting and multifaceted and literature.
I guess probably other people have opinions on this, but my feeling is that they do good work, but in terms of public perception, they break off one way or the other in terms of the wider public. You know, like the wider public is either sees an incoming Alan Moore thing and goes, that's a comic, and it goes over with Jack Kirby, or it goes, oh, that's like graphic novel nerd stuff, and it breaks over there and it ends up in the H.P. Lovecraft pile with other stuff that they aren't going to read. Like, because... why? I think probably the best metaphor for what's going to happen to comics, I guess, is what has happened to the really visionary science fiction novelists who never stopped being genre novelists. So Philip K. Dick, for example, is respectable, but in an underground sense, where every filmmaker of science fiction who makes popular mainstream films that people go watch knows who he is and likes him, but the general public are like, his last name is Dick? Who is this person? So he is either pulp or respectable to anyone in the know, but there's not very many people in the know, or who need to be, or feel a desire to be, or who want to be. Like, it involves reading, which is, not a big thing. And it involves art, which is even worse. So I think that they need to just make what they're going to make and not worry about where it ends up in the public's consciousness. They're always going to have their fans, and but it's never like, I just think the argument that if we would just stop making comics about this kind of thing and start making comics about that kind of thing, then comics, everyone would like comics, and then the world would be better because people are doing bad things instead of liking comics. Like, no, they're doing whatever the hell they like to do instead of reading comics. Let them do whatever that is. You know, like if they're going to cooking class instead of reading comics and watching football instead of reading comics, let them, you know. But I think there's an idea that if we just stopped focusing on whatever this person's peccadillo is or, you know, something, that it would just, oh, we're so close, we're not, you know. It's just like you're into that thing and it's weird and it always kind of will be. If you want to see a comics culture where comics are everywhere, then you could go to Japan. And crappy comics are everywhere. They're like, when you get your job in like, making, like designing the sole of a boot, they give you a little 8-page manga that it shows how to put the boot on, you know. It's like, that's the future that but there's still just as many good comics before that as after that. You know, it's like, they still have the same problem. They just have, instead of nobody reading comics, nobody reads good comics. Is that a better outcome? I don't know. So I think there will always be a sideline for it, but I don't think it's ever going to be. Yeah.
Well, I remember when all of my friends had a copy of the Furry Freak Brothers lying around somewhere, and it was just a casual thing. Now, it's a very special thing to read comics. It's specialized, and not a lot of people who are not comics readers do it anymore.
So at the beginning we heard that there was some thought about putting the three volumes out together, and instead they went out separately. And I was just wondering, is there any thought about taking the content and putting it out and still in some different forms, either putting it out digitally or the super high-end hardcover, you know, kind of, or and some other way of releasing what's in there?
Right.
And also, Russ, this will be our last question.
Okay. Well, there will be a boxed set of all three volumes coming out in the fall. As far as digital, I don't know. Seven Stories has been thinking about that. There are not any Kindle versions available. I think Amazon has one mistakenly listed for Volume 2, but it does not exist. They've been talking with various people who, you know, specialize in putting comics in digital form. But as far as I know, it's all just, it's talk. There are no solid plans. Veronica is shaking her head. No, okay. It's from Seven Stories. So yeah, working. Yeah, and Dan Simon, the head of Seven Stories, is not a big fan of digital publishing. Not a fan of ebooks. He likes the old school stuff, and he wanted. He's definitely leaning towards keeping them paper only. So that's where it stands. You know, I want to thank Aloud and the LA Library and the Library Foundation for having us here, and thank all of you for coming out, the artists.
Aloud is made possible through support provided by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, Errant Fox, City National Bank, KPMG, Donna and Martin J. Wolf, and the Bujaki Foundation. Additional support provided by the Los Angeles Public Library, the Council of the Library Foundation, the Stay Home and Read a Book Ball, and individual Library Foundation members. Media support provided by KCRW 89.9 FM, KUSC 91.5 FM, and LA Weekly. Aloud theme composed by Larry Karish.